from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll go face-to-face with the face-to-face exhibit at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
And to add to your summer reading list, I'll chat with thriller writer Brian Freeman. And I'll get a preview of the Indie Film Fest.
Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis Museum of Art recently opened the first exhibition devoted solely to portraits of the Neo-Impressionist movement. The IMA is the only U.S. venue for Face-to-Face, the Neo-Impressionist Portrait 1886 to 1904. Sharon Gamble invited Ellen Lee, the Wood Pulliam Distinguished Senior Curator, in for a visit the week the show opened to learn about the exhibit's long gestation period and how art was changing a century ago.
So before we talk about specifics of the show, I want to get you to define a term for us. What is neo-impressionism and who coined that?
Well, Sharon, that is a great direct question that I can answer in 25 words or less.
Wow. Impressive.
Neo-impressionism means very simply new impressionism. And I believe Georges Seurat, who created the style, would have told you it was new and improved. Because his concept was to build on many of the things the Impressionists had done, such as painting with brilliant colors. But he thought that they were a little too spontaneous, a little too intuitive. And so he had certain rules that he wanted to apply. And he confided in a very perceptive critic of the day named Félix Fénéon. And it was Fénéon in a review in 1886 who called the style New Impressionism, Neo-Impressionism.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, it's been more than a century, so I think maybe we forget that Impressionism itself was radical.
Absolutely.
Well, what did Impressionism bring by way of change?
In many ways, it was drastically different. The art that preceded it, which is usually considered academic, there were lots of rules about careful drawing and modeling, shading, and even the subject matter, which was often taken from mythology or history. The Impressionists were very sensitive to the fact that they wanted to show themselves as part of the modern era. So first of all, they started painting the scenes around them. You think of Monet painting the new railroad stations in Paris with the steam coming out of the locomotives, or Pizarro painting the views of Paris as it has changed. So it was very much of the moment. But they also didn't want to have to abide by the whole process of making an academic painting. They wanted to paint just what they perceived, and they were very attentive to color changes due to the atmosphere, the weather, whether it was morning or evening. And in order to convey that sense of immediate perception, they had to paint really quickly. It kind of makes sense if you're painting a moment in time. And so their brushwork became looser. Their painting was very spontaneous. And so this kind of loose brushwork that to many people of the day, frankly, just looked messy.
It looked like it lacked discipline.
That
probably.
Became yes, yeah. Yes. They were taking shortcuts. So that looked that became very controversial, and they also had new ways of exhibiting. And it's sort of hard to come to terms today with the fact that in 19th century Europe there were very few places for artists to exhibit their work, and it usually went through a place that was officially called the salon. And you had to have a team of jurors approve you. They decided where your work was hung. Hmm. So with artists like the Impressionists, who no surprise, were being rejected from those shows. Mm. So they went rogue, and they put their own exhibitions together. So that was another way that the Impressionists defied tradition.
Wow. Love it. Turbulent revolutionary times.
Yes. And I think they were so turbulent that then, as we look back on it today, we're surprised to see that there were artists then who came after the Impressionists who wanted to push the envelope even further.
Right, right. So neo-Impressionism is often associated with landscapes, but you're going a completely different direction with this exhibition.
That's right. Talk about going rogue. And you're right, Sharon. Of course, when we think of neo-Impressionism, we often think of Georges Seurat and his great outdoor painting of Sunday at the Grand Jatte, you know, with people relaxing on the banks of the Seine River in Paris. And I think the reason why there's been so much attention, rightly, focused on the landscapes is because of Seurat's goals, the artist who founded the movement. And at the heart of his approach was a desire to kind of be able to paint sunlight itself, to be able to infuse his paintings with luminosity and with even more brilliant color than the Impressionists had achieved. And so he was usually picking outdoor subjects. Sometimes they were city scenes, some remote scenes on the English Channel, for instance. But those have those. First of all, they're the most frequently painted subjects. So mm-hmm. there's simply more of them
sure.
than the portraits. But it was because of this interest in vibrant color that when we've looked at what the neo-Impressionists did, we tended to look at these examples of outdoor pictures. And as a result, this other genre, a really basic one for all of us, portraits, was kind of ignored. And it was my colleague, Jane Block, who is an art historian at the University of Illinois, who first kind of identified this gap. And so we've been working together for many years to kind of fill that gap and take a look at the amazing variety of likenesses that the neo-Impressionist portrait painters gave us.
So you just referenced something and you passed by it very quickly, but, to the public, this exhibit is all fresh and new and it just came together in the last few weeks or months. But this is a labor of love for years behind the scenes for you.
I almost hate to admit how long. I would say we have been working on this about 8 years.
That's a long gestation.
It is very long. That's right. And when it finally comes together, it's absolutely thrilling.
Yeah. So thinking about what you said about the capturing of color, certainly in portraits, does this result in a focus on figuring out that at a distance, someone's skin may look like one color, but to a painter, it's really a multiplicity of colors?
Absolutely. I'm thinking of one portrait in particular that's actually part of the IMA's permanent collection, and then we are including it in the show. And that's really one reason why we can take a leadership role in organizing the show, is because of the IMA's strong permanent collection in neo-Impressionism. But there's one of a portrait of a very dignified-looking soldier, complete with his epaulettes and his Légion d'honneur ribbon medal on his chest. And you would think, all right, he's got sort of pink cheeks. And you look then more closely at the picture, and you will see that his skin is actually comprised of so many different colors that then somehow do resolve themselves into a credible likeness. But the neo-Impressionists were so intent on these vibrant color schemes, and they knew that, for instance, opposites on the color wheel, sometimes we call those complementary colors, and when you juxtapose those, you get the most vibrant contrast. So their harmonies were really based on playing with those opposites so that they could suggest this very vibrant quality.
So isn't this about the time that color theory is first?
Perfect question. And one of the elements we will have in the exhibition are examples of a lot of the treatises that were produced in France and America in the 19th century that deal with this very thing of color theory.
What caused color people to start theorizing about color? Do we know?
Well, I think it's part of a larger ethos, a larger sentiment and belief in late 19th century Europe of the power of science. You know, this was a time of great confidence in science. One way that I always tell people to associate it with is the Eiffel Tower in Paris, built in 1889 for the World's Fair to show off the prowess of the French. And Gustave Eiffel was a brilliant engineer. He knew how to do this sort of thing. This is a time when, you know, Jules Verne is speculating about, you know, traveling outside of the Earth. The Suez Canal is being created. So in general, there's a thought of kind of better living through science. And one of the things then that Seurat did, because he wanted to add structure and method to what the Impressionists had been doing, he's the one who turned to these scientific theories, looking, I think, for the basis for his art. So it was ground in these ideas about how color behaves and also about how our eye perceives color.
Right, right. And this is too big a question and too crazy a question for the scope of this interview, but sometime help me put together a panel, because I've always been fascinated by how art changed when electric lighting reached critical mass, because that's happening
yes.
right about this era too. So
well, and that's a very good point, Sharon, because we have a series of drawings in the exhibition, black and white drawings that I think will be a great surprise to our visitors, because, you know, they're thinking neo-impressionism, it's about color, but it's also about contrast. And when you have a black and white drawing, that's kind of the most fundamental contrast you can have. And there's a whole series of pictures in the drawing gallery that are devoted to people gathered in the evening reading and sewing around a lamp, a lamp above their, say, their dining room table, on their dining room table, that brings them all together in this beautiful kind of twilight effect. And, you know, someone will be sewing and the next person may be reading or drawing or even dozing. But there's a really beautiful, intimate quality to these drawings. And I think it does stem from, as you're saying, that there is electricity and the light is there. And I think the artists were attracted to the effect of that kind of contrast of light and shadow.
Sure. Speaking of large thinking, you were talking about science and enabling people to think, we can build the Suez Canal, we can build the Eiffel Tower, as astonishing a feat. I mean, you know, people still see it for the first time in 2014 and are amazed. There are some paintings that are on a very grand scale. There are life-size portraits of three sisters. I want to hear about the three sisters whose portraits are in this exhibit.
Yes. These are three pictures painted by the Belgian artist Theo van Rijsselberg, painted over a period of 6 years, of each of the three young women in a family named Seth. They were from a very cultured Brussels family, and so each done individually. And I like to think that the IMA has produced a family reunion at this exhibition, because we have Alice, Maria, and Irma. And as the girls grew up and, well, they were young women when they were painted, but then as they married and started their own households, of course, their portraits went with them. But over the years, because they were painted in between 1888 and 1894, each of these pictures ended up in a different European museum, one in France, one in Belgium, and one in Switzerland. And so now, for the first time in the United States, we are bringing all three young women together for a special reunion. And we designed a special kind of niche space in the IMA gallery so that you can see each of the pieces and kind of see how they relate to one another. And two of the three women were very talented musicians. And so we've also developed a concert program that is going to accompany the exhibition. Oh. And some of the performances will take place right there in front of the sisters.
Sharon Gamble with Ellen Lee, the IMA's Wood Pulliam Distinguished Senior Curator. Face-to-Face, the Neo-Impressionist Portrait, 1886 to 1904, will feature more than 30 paintings and 20 works on paper by artists including Paul Signac, Henry Edmund Cross, Maximilian Luce, and Vincent van Gogh, and will be on view in the Allen Whitehall Clues Special Exhibition Gallery through September 7th, 2014. You can learn more at imamuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. It may be hot this summer, but in his newest thriller titled The Cold Nowhere, best-selling author Brian Freeman brings the long-awaited return of Lieutenant Jonathan Stride to the bitter cold of Duluth, Minnesota. Travis DiNicola spoke with Freeman by phone about his new book.
Hey, Brian, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. I'm glad to be back with you.
Yeah, looking forward very much to you coming back to Indianapolis. It's been a while since you've been here touring for your books, and so we're really looking forward to having you here, and especially at Indie Reads Books on Thursday the 24th. That's awesome.
Absolutely. I am looking forward to it.
So you've been on our show a couple times, and it seems you've got a great following here in Indianapolis. I think you originally first came here thanks to the Mystery Company bookstore brought you in for the books that you do, the series with Jonathan Stride. And you've got another Jonathan Stride book out, The Cold Nowhere. Tell me a bit about this, because it's a great series.
Yeah, I had done a couple standalones after doing five Stride novels, and so I've been getting those little nudges from readers saying, well, when are we going to get more Stride? So the Cold Nowhere brings Stride back, brings the series back to Duluth, and when I was starting the design of The Cold Nowhere, I just had this image of Stride coming back to his little cottage out on Park Point on Lake Superior in Duluth very late one night, and he comes into his cottage and finds this teenage girl hiding in his bedroom closet. She's soaking wet, wrapped in a blanket, and she says that someone is trying to kill her. And Stride has to decide whether he can trust this girl and has to find out what's really going on in her life.
Now tell me a bit about Stride, for especially for people who may not have read other books in the series. As you said, he's a detective. It starts out in Duluth, but in some of the other books, he ends up in Vegas for a while, right?
In Stripped, which was the second book, yeah, he went to Vegas and then came back to Duluth in my third book, Stalked, which was this ice-cold winter thriller. You know, Stride and Duluth, they just go hand in hand. Stride is very much this northern Minnesota outdoorsman. He kind of tucks his chin against the wind and keeps moving on. You know, I don't like to write about superheroes, and I don't like to write about supervillains. I just like to take ordinary people and put them in some dark and difficult situations. So someone like Stride, he's a detective, but I think why readers relate to him is that he's a real person, and he tries hard but doesn't always make the right choices, and yet they know at heart that that his heart is in the right place.
Putting him in dark and cold situations is part of it, too.
Yeah, I will say when I was titling this one The Cold Nowhere, I didn't realize how prophetic it would turn out to be for this past Midwestern winter.
So I got to ask you, I mean, obviously, you know, you were writing the book a while back, but here we are now in the middle of summer, and you're dealing with a cold book. How's that working out for you?
You know, I always tell people this is a great book to bring out to the beach on a hot day. It'll give you some cool shivers running up your spine.
There you go, some instant air conditioning, and portable as well. So, when did the book come out? Because it has just been this summer, pretty recently, right?
Yeah, it came out in April.
Okay, and you've been doing some traveling and touring and getting good reception?
doing a lot of traveling around the Midwest, and the book came out in April, but April in Minnesota was still very much winter this year, so there was still a fair amount of snow we were driving through heading from event to event. Now I think hopefully we're beyond that.
Now, Brian, you said that you had taken a little time off with the Jonathan Stride series and had been doing some other books. Tell me a bit about the other work you've been doing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a book called The Bone House, which was set up in Door County in Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. introduced a new character called Cab Bolton. He's kind of a quirky Florida detective. And I envisioned The Bone House very much as a standalone, but readers really embraced Cab as a character. And so my next book out in the U.S. Next spring will be the second in a new Cab Bolton series. And then after The Bone House, I wrote a book called Spilled Blood, which takes place in sort of the rural ghost towns of southwestern Minnesota. And it centers on this feud between two rural towns and the teenagers that got caught up in the midst of this feud. And I was just delighted. Spilled Blood last year won the award for Best Hardcover Novel in the 2013 Thriller Awards. So that was just a tremendous honor.
How important to you is place? I mean, you're from the Midwest, from Minnesota. A lot of your books are set there. Why do you choose to do that?
You know, I really like to give readers a you are there feel in my books. I want them to feel as if they've been dropped down into the middle of every chapter, and they can hear it and smell it and taste it and touch it and feel it happening all around them. And so I love to scout locations throughout the Midwest and bring that sort of remoteness and authenticity and drama that I think is true of the Midwest settings. You know, I'm a Midwestern boy. I grew up going to a little cottage with my folks in Coloma, Michigan. In fact, I'm going to be there to stop by and see it next week.
Nice.
And so much of that is what shapes my books today. It's that love of the Midwest that I had growing up.
Well, so place is definitely a big part of it, but so is crime. Tell me about your interest. I mean, what inspires you in terms of the stories about these, I mean, sometimes pretty gruesome crimes that Stride and your other characters are dealing with, trying to solve and encounter?
Yeah, there are some dark things that go on in the books, and sometimes I mean one of the great things about being a mystery and thriller writer is that you can actually take sort of unsolved crimes and bring something that people don't always get in real life, which is justice and answers. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes in my books, when I'm starting the plots, I'll actually start with a true crime that interests me and that has a lot of drama to it, and I'll start playing with the circumstances and I'll turn it into something that works for one of my plots, and you have the opportunity to get to the end and see how the riddle truly gets solved.
So when you're writing a book like this, like with the Stride series, and again, the most recent one is The Cold Nowhere, obviously, you know, you've got a lot of fans who've read the other four books and are really looking forward to continuing the story. And there's elements that have to be continued on because you want it to feel like it's a complete narrative. But other readers might just be picking this one up cold, so to speak. And how do you sort of balance that as an author dealing with a series, you know, so that you can sort of catch people up, but respect the longtime readers?
Yeah, that's absolutely the most important balancing act of doing a series, because I want new readers to be able to embrace each new book and to read it and feel that they're getting a fully featured introduction to the characters and that they're not getting sort of things revealed from the previous books that harm their enjoyment.
Sure,
and
right,
at the same time, you want series readers to not feel like, well, we've been down this road many times before. So it definitely is a key balancing act. With series, I kind of look at it and think that you meet someone new in your life and they are at a certain point in their lives and you meet them and you get to know them and you like who they are. It makes you want to go back and find out more about how they got to that point in their lives. And I think mm-hmm. that's true of a series as well for new readers, is you meet Stride now in The Cold Nowhere, and my hope is that you're so drawn to him as a character that you want to go back to the earlier books and see what it was that guided Stride to that particular place in his life. And for series readers, one of the things I do is I'm always exploring new aspects of the character's past mm-hmm. That readers haven't discovered before, and so that's something that's important about The Cold Nowhere, is that this teenage girl that Stride finds in his bedroom closet, winds up being the daughter of a woman that represents kind of one of the great failures of Stride's life, a woman that he tried and failed to protect early in his career. And that's a story that series readers don't know about Stride. So for them, it's an opportunity to sort of discover a new aspect of his life that they haven't seen in an earlier book.
Well, and then my guess is it's also a way for you to discover new aspects of the character. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here, but like with that example you just gave where the readers are learning something new about Stride's past, is that something that you also sort of discovered and came up with as you're getting into this book? And you know, as you continue to write about Stride, like, oh, I wonder if this happened to him in the past, or, you know, sort of finding out things about the character himself.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, I'm learning about these characters as they go along too, and they have a way of surprising me too. Things happen with the characters in every book that I'm not necessarily anticipating when I start putting an outline on paper. But when you actually start drafting the book, the characters take on a life of their own, and they start to guide you. So Stride is Stride has sometimes taken me in some new directions that I wasn't expecting, and sometimes he makes a good choice, and sometimes he makes a mistake that I don't necessarily see coming.
So it becomes a thriller for you too.
There we go.
Hey, so I have to ask, any word on turning these into TV or movies, or any talk about that at this point?
Well, you know, we keep knocking on the door, and we've got folks that are looking at that. You know, I think it would be great to see Stride, particularly on the TV side, because I think you're seeing so much creativity and energy in the writing for TV series these days.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing longer story arcs. I mean, you look at some of the great recent miniseries. You know, take something like, you know, Broadchurch coming in from the UK, where they really have this longer story arc that goes across several episodes, and that works perfectly for my books. Because
sure.
My stories tend to be, you know, complex and a lot of threads that come together, and so the long format of TV would work perfectly for that. So we keep knocking on the door. We'll cross our fingers and see what happens.
Definitely keep our fingers crossed for that. Can you give us a little heads up on what you're working on next? Or
yeah, in fact, the next book is done. That's the new Cab Bolton book. So
okay.
Reintroducing Cab from the Bone House, and then I'm about halfway through another Stride novel right now.
Excellent, excellent. Well, do you get a chance to write when you're on the road at all, or is that a hard thing for you to do?
That's a pretty hard thing for me to do. Usually when I'm off doing events, I kind of just focus on having the opportunity to talk to readers, and frankly, I'm always absorbing things from people and places that I go, so it tends to be a pretty rich creative experience being out on the road, and I always end up taking a lot of notes back that they may find their way into books later on.
Maybe we can give you some inspiration for murder when you're here in Indianapolis.
There we go.
Brian, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me by phone and talk about The Cold Nowhere. It's great to hear from you again, and looking forward very much to you being at the bookstore at Indie Reads Books next Thursday.
I'm looking forward to it as well.
Great. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Travis. Take care.
You too.
Travis DiNicola with thriller writer Brian Freeman. His newest book is called The Cold Nowhere. Freeman will be at Indie Reads Books on Thursday, July 24th at 5:30 in the evening. For more information, go to bfreemanbooks.com. That's the letter B, freemanbooks.com. Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches.
I bet
I
you must make
amends. Well, we have a Janis Joplin-inspired event on our calendar we call What Do We Do?
Yes, we do. I can't wait for this concert. This is going to be really fun.
This is so fun. I got to see Karen Irwin do her Janis Joplin tribute the first time around. Gosh, it's been, I think it was cold weather. I think I remember wearing a coat. It's called A Piece of Her Heart. A tribute to Janis Joplin, where at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club, just go. It is so much fun.
It is not sedate at all.
She's amazing. It's like she's channeling Janis.
Yeah.
So even if you're too young to have any idea who Janis Joplin is, do yourself a favor and go. I should tell you when it is. It's July 25th and 20th. July 25th and 26th. July 25th and 26th. Find out more at the Cabaret.
Mercedes-Benz and Peace of My Heart.
Oh,
and,
yeah. Bobby McGee.
Bobby McGee, of Woo-hoo. Course. Lots of great songs off that.
Great summer music.
The Pearl album and so many other great recordings that she did. Also, there's a lot of great concerts going on at the zoo. Zoolapalooza.
Easy for you to say.
Started in June and it continues. The last one is on July 18th and it's featuring the band West Central, which performs a whole bunch of jazz classics as well as some contemporary music. And those concerts are on Friday nights. But then also Animals and All That Jazz is going on at the zoo through August 14th. And let's see. So if you're listening to us tonight on Thursday, you maybe can't quite catch Cynthia Lane, but you might want to look for next week. Because next week at the zoo on July 24th, you've got Janice Jaffe and Davida with special guest Mark Rosselli, one of our favorites, of course, great performer, great arranger, and some really nice vocals with those musicians. And then on the 31st, Direct Contact, it's a Latin jazz band, very high energy, you'll enjoy that. August 7th, Blair Clark, kind of a mix of pop and R&B and soul and some jazz and some stuff inspired by the Great American Songbook. And then wrapping up the Animals and All That Jazz series, the Red Hot Whiskey Sippers, on August 14th with a whole bunch of New Orleans bayou-based music. So lots of fun at Animals and All That Jazz at the zoo. Again, those are on Thursday night concerts.
What a treat. For some completely different critters, don't forget to go see the Terracotta Warriors over at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. Interesting programming going on around there. And don't forget to check into the Take Me There China exhibit, which is ongoing. You can, quote-unquote, fly over the Great Wall of China, land in Beijing, and embark on a journey through contemporary China. So kind of putting the Terracotta Warriors in a contemporary context. Always so much to see and do and learn. Oh, don't tell the kids they'll learn anything, but at the Children's Museum.
Running through August 17th at Beef and Board's Dinner Theater, the Church Basement Ladies serve up an all-new show. It's called A Mighty Fortress Is Our Basement. Church Basement Ladies. It should be a lot of fun. I just love the title. It's the fourth and, as they say, funniest installment yet in this popular series about the Church Basement Ladies. Should be a lot of fun out at Beef and Board's Theater through August 17th.
So we were kind of referring to great pop and rock music of the tail end of the last century a little bit earlier. I want to remind you that Bob Direk's production of Hair is on stage through July 20th at the Athenaeum Theater, 2800825, 317-2800825, or Bob Direk's, that's DIREX.com, for information about that production.
Very good. Hey, on July 19th from 3 to 6 at the Gallery 924, that's the Arts Council's gallery, they are having the Ed Funk Memorial Show. And this is a true memorial show, reunion of old friends, celebrating the artist and painter, printmaker, and owner of Dolphin Papers, Ed Funk. And this will be a great get-together if you knew Ed or knew his work. So again, that's on July 19th from 3 to 6 at the Gallery 924.
Fabulous. Hey, I have a save the date item. Saturday, August 9th at the Basile Opera Center in Indianapolis. It's time for the 5th annual Lobster Palooza, which sounds like one of those rock mosh pit shows, but it really isn't. It's a casual and exciting evening of entertainment, live music, and the centerpiece, of course, is a traditional Maine lobster boil featuring succulent Maine lobster with award-winning clam chowder, steamed clams, fresh vegetables, and corn on the cob. The fresh Maine lobster is brought in the night before, and it's billed as being so sweet and tender it practically melts in your mouth. You can check that out at the opera's website. And again, that's coming. It'll be here before you know it. Saturday, August 9th, Lobster Palooza.
If you have not yet been to a concert on the lawn, the Farm Bureau Insurance lawn at White River State Park, then you still got a couple chances as they wrap up their season. Gavin DeGraw and Matt Nathanson are performing on Sunday the 20th, and Panic at the Disco is going to be performing on Wednesday, July 23rd. Humphreys McGee on Saturday, the 26th of July, and wrapping up with John Fogerty on Tuesday, July 29th. All concerts at the Farm Bureau Insurance Lawn at the White River State Park. A great place to see some great concerts.
Hey, a couple more weeks to take advantage of Late Night Wednesdays at the Eitelkirch Museum. If you've been dying to see the Ansel Adams Show and just can't fit it into your normal weekend schedule or weekday schedule, you can go on Wednesday evening until 8 o'clock. The show features 80 of Adams' personally chosen photographs and just a gorgeous show. Even if you haven't ever seen an Ansel Adams photo, I suspect you're going to fall in love with this. They're also doing a closing party on July 30th from 5 to midnight. It's called Ansel Adams Final Shot, $15, and lots of fun and entertainment. And, of course, one last chance to visit your favorite Ansel Adams photo in the show. Find out more at eitelkirch.org.
Very good. And last thing I got, if you happen to be in Elwood this summer.
What?
Yes. Well, Elwood Concerts in the Park is continuing on, and they are having a lot of great concerts. Their season continues on July 27th with a salute to veterans featuring the Indiana National Guard Band. And they'll have free hot dogs for the first 500 people.
Wow.
Which sounds pretty fun.
That's a lot of dogs.
And then on August 10th, the J. Fox Band, a variety group, and they will also have free hot dogs. And August 24th, the Sundown Band, which is sort of a 60s and Jimmy Buffett group, with free hot dogs. And August 31st, the end of the season bash with Mark Reed and Blair Carman, the Bellevue Boys, and free hot dogs. That sounds fun. So all the concerts are held in the Jim Noop Band Shell located in Callaway Park in Elwood, Indiana, and all the concerts begin at 4 p.m. Sounds like a lot of fun. If you happen to be in Elwood this summer, check out one of their concerts.
For what is Elwood famous?
I can't wait to find out.
What was billed while it was still in operation in this way as the world's only fly-in, drive-in. So you could drive in or you could fly your small plane, which I did. With a friend,
if you happen to get really hungry
your
in the
small
well, that's
plane,
the problem, they don't really serve food on planes anymore.
And pull, that's right, and pull up, and they would hang the tray on your plane window.
Wow, that's so cool!
I believe it's still operating as a drive-in, but I don't think there's an airstrip by it anymore. Don't quote me on that. Check it out before you go there for your hot
dog.
Good
to know. Okay, Sharon, we'll be back next week with more things you never even thought about.
That's right.
On that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The 11th Annual Indie Film Fest opens this week with Fox Searchlight's Origins. I sat down to talk with the festival's Craig Mintz and Luke Sanders to find out more. Craig, Luke, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Absolutely. And congratulations on the 11th Annual Indie Film Fest, which is pretty cool. It's going into 11 years. And big congratulations on the gorgeous festival guide that came in my Sunday paper this weekend.
Hey, nice. No problem. Glad you liked it.
Yeah, you guys kind of nailed on this one. I mean, you got new sponsors. This is the most attractive guide I've seen you guys put out before. And it's just a great listing of all the movies and everything going on. Very cool stuff.
We did it a little differently this year, and we went very simple. We felt this year was going to be a big year for us as far as like an audience builder, and we wanted to make it very approachable for folks that maybe have never been to a film festival. So we actually broke up the information on by calendar, not by the film. So if you have a day, you can see what's playing on that day very easily, and you can say, well, I'm going to go check this one out. So,
yeah, it seemed very user-friendly going through it and made a lot of sense. And okay, so let me ask you this. Why a film festival? Why do we need a film festival? What makes a film festival special?
Film festivals are special, namely because they bring a lot of films to a certain market that would never come here theatrically.
Mm-hmm.
Any of these movies, and any movie that we've played in years past, you definitely can check them out, whether it's on Netflix now or video on demand. Some of them do get theatrical release, but very few.
Sure.
This actually provides an outlet for the community to get together and see these movies theatrically, which is a very social activity. Movies, mm-hmm. you know, going to see a movie, a lot of people don't think about it, but it is a very social activity. Although you may sit in a theater with 200 other people in the dark watching a movie, you know, what happens pre and post, the conversations that are had, the opinions that people share with each other is kind of right up our alley. That's always what we want to highlight and champion. So film festivals are always going to have a place. They're always going to be evolving like any other, you know, creative outlet mm-hmm. or art outlet. But, you know, to put a festival together, to curate a festival for Indianapolis, central Indiana, to be able to come see these movies as a group and appreciate them is great.
There is something very special, of course, still about going to the movies and being in that theater and hearing how people react, you know, what they laugh to, what they shout at, you know.
I can't tell you how many times I've watched a movie, you know, by myself, you know, at home, mm-hmm. getting them curated for the festival, and watching them in a theater, a crowded theater, like, there are places that I wouldn't normally laugh that an audience will laugh. It's a whole different dynamic, and you experience it completely differently if you experience it with a group of people.
I remember years ago when first time I saw Blue Velvet in the theater, I went with my mom, and the two of us were, like, laughing throughout the whole movie, and no one else
Nobody
in the theater
was.
And it's like, well, that's awkward. But, you know, or, I mean, more recently, like, Fault in Our Stars, you know, everyone's weeping and stuff. But, yeah, it is an experience. And, of course, I mean, the benefit of Film Fest is it's also curated, right?
Correct, yeah. We have a group of screening committee members that actually watch every movie that's submitted and kind of go from there as far as assembling the programming. So we got well over 600 films this year.
Wow.
And whittled it down to 91. So yeah, it's a curated event, it's a juried event, and it's got cash prize awards for the filmmakers that are nominated, but win each of the category prizes.
I want to talk about the awards in just a moment, but what do you guys look for when you're going through these film submissions? Luke?
Yeah, the screeners themselves are kind of the heroes who take the burden of watching all these films onto their backs, I should say. But as far as the films, they're incredibly varied. I think that's one thing that makes our festival very special, at times perhaps very challenging, but certainly adds up to a lot of films that you're not going to see elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're set categories and ratings and things you might expect, like cinematography, acting, directing, those kind of things. But a lot of it is too the uniqueness of the story and the unique perspectives and different pieces of different stories, whether that be narrative or documentary, that
mm-hmm.
You know, challenge, entertain, delight, laugh, cry, yell at the screen, whatever the
yell at the screen, right?
Or walk out, which is okay too. Yeah.
Tickle your fancy,
right?
So, I mean, it sounds like you guys have a lot of filmmakers submitting films for this. Part of that's because of the reputation you're building and the prizes. Tell me about the award night this year. Is on this coming Saturday night.
So yeah, Saturday night. We've decided to move. We've always traditionally done our awards the last Saturday for closing night mm-hmm. of the festival. And one of the big comments that we've been getting from customers lately is, well, I don't have enough time to watch all of the award winners, and I'd like to see them theatrically. Mm-hmm. We used to do like a best of series that final Sunday. So we decided to move the awards to that first weekend for a couple different reasons.
So that's on Saturday the 19th.
Saturday the 19th, mm-hmm. correct. It helps focus on getting filmmakers into Indianapolis. One of our missions is to try to get as many filmmakers in to interact with the audience. So that helps focus them to that first weekend. Plus, then, after we announce the awards, most if not all, of the award-winning films will actually play once, if not twice, post-award, so people will actually have a chance
Excellent.
To go see them in a theatrical setting.
And the award ceremony, that's going to be at the IMA, and in fact, most of the movies are either at the IMA, at the Toby, or at the State Museum, right?
Correct, yeah. On the Friday nights of the festival, we're actually going to move downtown and go to the IMAX and the State Museum.
Cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, great venues for both of that.
All great movie watching venues.
So if people want to check out the schedule, if they don't have the beautifully produced physical schedule in hand, they can, of course, go to your website.
Yes, www.indiefilmfest.org, and you can get a list of all the movies, the schedule. You can get discount on hotel room nights, all kinds of fun stuff on there.
And you guys have different specials, too, on tickets, right? I mean, like, most movies are $10, but you can get, like, bundles of tickets or an all-access pass or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. So the all-access pass gets you into absolutely everything. With the bundles, there are 10-ticket bundles. There are you know, smaller deals that we have one running on Living Social right now.
Nice.
Different ways to hopefully see the broadest slate of movies that you can fit into your schedule.
So let's talk about some of these movies. I am really curious about this one titled Life After Beth. It's about a guy whose girlfriend comes back from the dead.
Yeah.
<It's> Which sounds horrifying. Yeah.
On many different levels, actually. A, she wants to eat you, and B, she's back. An excellent, they're calling it a zombie rom-com. It stars Audrey Plaza and Dane Hahn, John C. Reilly, I mean, Anna Kendrick.
A great
cast. Yeah, it's got a fantastic cast, and it follows Audrey Plaza. She goes on a hike and gets bitten by a snake. And post-funeral, her boyfriend, who's struggling with the fact that she's passed, has a surprise one night when she pops back up, and he has the opportunity to air grievances with her post-death, I guess you could say. And it's not only is it's a really good dark comedy, the message in it is quite good, and then kind of the resolve of it, I think, is really, really good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That sounds very fun.
Yeah.
Tell me about, is it Kumiko, the treasure hunter?
So, yeah, Kumiko is actually the film that's going to play prior to our award ceremony on the 19th. And if you're a fan of the movie Fargo, this one's definitely for you. The film's a narrative. It's done by a pair of brothers that are the Zeller brothers. They're famous within the indie world. And the movie follows a young Japanese woman who's obsessed with a VHS copy that she has of the film Fargo. She falls into this reality where the briefcase of money that Steve Buscemi hides in the snow at the end of the film is in fact real and is just buried there in Fargo in the snow. So she draws this crude map on a napkin or something like that and gets a flight to Fargo and tries to go find this treasure, basically. And it's this tale that's woven through, like, reality and not reality, and you never quite know where you're at within the movie. And it's just so well produced, and she is an amazing actress. It's a pretty neat movie.
You know, I always wonder in real life if, like, people who live in Fargo get tired of, like, you know, Fargo tourists that are there because they saw the movie and stuff. So
where's the fellow, eh?
Yeah, I mean, this must play with that a lot, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what?
It doesn't, like, go heavy-handed into Fargo. It's a very subtle nod to the film.
Okay.
And you get a lot of clips, and obviously she constantly is like, Fargo? Like, because she's real fractured English. But it's kind of a fun kind of tale add-on to the film, so to speak.
Now, not all the films are feature films, as you mentioned. I mean, there are shorts, there's documentaries. One of them, Impossible Light, sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, Luke.
Yeah, that's a great one, especially, I think, given the appropriateness of our screening in an art museum and it focusing very heavily on not only art, but I think art that pushes the boundaries of the way that someone would normally think of an art as a picture up on a wall with the light on it and a bench in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it follows an artist and his supporting cast on their mission to put up this interactive light sculpture. I'm even struggling what to call it, on the side of the Bay Bridge in San Francisco.
And this is a real thing that happened.
Real thing.
Oh, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah. So, like, LED lights they're trying to install on, or did install on, the side of the Bay Bridge.
Yes. Huh. And it's absolutely stunning. Like, yeah. You watch the film and the toil that they went through to get this installed, and then the reveal, you know, now you watch it and it's amazing.
Let's pick out one or two more other films that you guys are just really hot for right now that you're excited that you're bringing to Fest.
I have a favorite. It's a documentary called The Ballad of Shovels and Rope, and
Is that about the band?
It's about the band.
Oh, I love that band.
I had never heard of the band before I watched this movie, and as soon as I finished it, like, I ran out and bought the album. Like,
yeah,
I became
husband and wife,
husband and
sort
wife.
Of this funky country, almost
folk
like
duo.
You know, I kind of think of them as like if Jack White was playing country music.
Yes,
or
yes,
you know?
That's a perfect way to put it. So this documentary follows their recording of their first studio album.
Okay.
So it's kind of them literally recording this album in the back of their van as they were touring. They would pick up other artists along the way to chime in. And it's the dynamic between the couple is amazing. Her voice is just stunning.
Yeah.
And to see them interact and to see them grow as an act from obscurity to award winning.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still flying below the radar right now. There's a lot of people that have not heard of them. And this movie just catapults them into that forefront of music.
They were actually here at the Marat last fall, and I'd never heard of them before I went into the show and just fell in love with them after hearing them live. They're great.
The nice thing about this documentary, too, is it's actually directed by a gentleman by the name of Jace Freeman. He's from Carmel, so he's from Indiana.
Cool.
Yeah, so he lives down in Nashville, and he'll be back for the screenings as well.
Luke, what's one film you really excited about?
Yeah, that's an easy question for me. So one of my favorites out of the slate this year is a horror movie called Shantali. That's from Laos, or Lao, depending on we won't argue pronunciation here. That's that's for another venue. But it's a fascinating film for a few reasons. It's a very slow-burn, psychological thriller. It starts out and just kind of punches you in the gut and grows with a very, I would almost compare it to a Hitchcock film in that it has feelings of being closed in and being watched and all those sort of things. But it's fascinating to me because it's, I believe, the first Laotian film ever directed by a woman in its history as a country. It comes from a very conservative government that has a censorship board and all that kind of thing. And it was made for an audience that has never seen a horror movie and doesn't, in effect, know what a horror movie is or should be. So it's extremely interesting in the way that it develops the character, the acting, and the story's fantastic. And I just fell in love with the film the first time I saw it.
Yeah, that opening scene of that movie is brutal. It's it does literally punch you in the gut, but it is such a good movie.
So very interesting for another extremely unique perspective on what a horror film could be. Maybe leave the kiddos at home for that one.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good. Sounds like a great lineup. So many films and a great week and a half you guys got in front of you. The 11th Annual Indie Film Fest for 2014, taking place at the State Museum as well at the IMA. Craig Mintz, Luke Sanders, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. And make sure people check out IndieFilmFest.org for the complete schedule of all the great movies that you guys have brought to town. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out about a new study that looks at the arts in Indianapolis. And there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.